All right. So Exodus 1, verse 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increasing in number, in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramesses as a store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shepharah and Puah, "When you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people: "Every Hebrew boy that is born you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live."
Jacob had heard great things about uni. He'd enjoyed school. It had felt comfortable. It had felt like home. But towards the end, he was feeling increasingly hungry. School just wasn't really satisfying him anymore. And he knew that if he stayed there any longer, his mind would slowly wither away and starve. But Jacob had heard reports of a mighty land, the land of UWA. And he'd heard that UWA's rulers had built great buildings, and they'd stored up great stores of knowledge to feed their people for generations to come. And so he begged the rulers to let him in. And as he waited, longing to be saved from intellectual starvation, he became increasingly desperate. He found himself during the daytime watching Dr. Phil. And at nighttime, he was searching for cat videos on YouTube. Jacob could feel his mind starving. Then good news came, an offer from UWA to come and feed on their riches. Finally, Jacob could look forward to being well fed, to a life of comfort in the greatest university in the land. Riveting lectures, fascinating tutorials, exciting labs, witty philosophical debates with his friends on the oak lawn. Finally, Jacob could feed to his heart's content, confident that his future was secure. But then, somewhere around week 3, everything changed. Jacob discovered that the rulers of the university didn't actually know him. Worse than that, he discovered that they had put slave masters over him, who oppressed him with compulsory tutorials and group assignments. They made his life bitter with forced labour in essays and tutorials. And no matter how hard Jacob worked, there always seemed to be more to do. Every essay was followed by another essay, every lab by another lab. And the slave drivers just kept cracking the whip. His life meant nothing to them as long as they could achieve international excellence. To Jacob's horror, he discovered that in the land of plenty, he had become a slave. And he couldn't help but wonder, has God forgotten me? Welcome to UWA. See, sometimes things seem to be going really well, don't they? You think you're onto a good thing, and then suddenly, somehow along the way, things flip. And what you thought was fantastic suddenly turns out to be slavery. You might have experienced it with school. You may be about to experience it with uni. It might have been a relationship that's gone bad, or a job that just turned out to be unutterably boring. It might be sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It all seems so good, but now you just feel trapped. And that is where the people of Israel find themselves at the start of the book of Exodus. The man Jacob, the grandson of Abraham, who's also known, Jacob is also known as Israel, has been living in the land of Canaan, sort of where Israel is, Palestine. But then a famine had broken out and all 70 of his family had moved to Egypt. They'd moved to Egypt because they'd heard that there were great stores of food there. And they were welcomed with open arms. Because, to everyone's surprise, except God's, it turns out that Jacob's long-lost son, Joseph, missing presumed dead, is actually alive, and more than alive, he's the Prime Minister of Egypt. He's running the whole show. He is the right-hand man of Pharaoh. So they all move there. So they've moved down from Canaan into the land of Egypt to a region called Goshen, up near the Nile Delta. And life is good in Egypt. They flourish. Joseph and his brothers, they have lots of kids. And their kids have lots of kids. And their kids have lots of kids. And their kids have lots of kids. And suddenly, they're an enormous group of people. They're flourishing. In fact, the descendants of Israel become so numerous that we're told in verse 7 that the land was filled with them. Which helps to explain why the Egyptians are a little bit worried. But it also tells us something about God. See, way back in Genesis chapter 12, Genesis, the first book of the Bible, just before Exodus, God grabs this random guy, Abraham. Don't know much about him, except he's a random guy wandering around a part of the world that we would call Iraq. And God grabs him and he makes promises to him. He says to him, "Go from your country, your people and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you." So there's this promise, this multifaceted promise, that you could really sum up as land, offspring, and blessings. There you go. Land, offspring, and a blessing to all nations. That's God's promise to Abraham. And it's a promise that is incredibly significant because it's a promise that controls the whole of history. You won't learn about it probably in your history classes or in your ancient history classes, but this promise shapes the whole direction of human history, the whole direction of the world. And the interesting thing is that at the start of Exodus, we discover that God is keeping his promise. Israel are flourishing. They are turning into a great nation. God has not forgotten them. But not everyone is happy about Israel's offspring. See, the Egyptians see Israel increasing in number, and they are frightened. They're worried. It's not that they're worried about being swamped by foreigners, which lots of Australians seem to be worried about. No, they're not worried about the foreigners coming to Egypt. They're actually worried about them leaving. See, Egypt at the time is a little bit like the nations around the Persian Gulf at the moment, the sort of Gulf states, where you've got a group of people who are the natives, the local inhabitants, but then you've got a huge population of guest workers as well. In some of those countries in the Persian Gulf, the number of guest workers outnumbers the number of locals. And the thing they're worried about is not more guest workers coming. They love guest workers coming because they build all the stuff for them. They do all the hard manual labour. What they're terrified of is that maybe one of their enemies, one of the nations nearby who don't like them, could incite these people to revolt and leave. Because if they leave, then the whole economy collapses. Overnight, Riyadh, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, they will go from boom towns to ghost towns. They're terrified of people leaving. And that's the situation that Egypt is in Exodus. So they decide to clamp down hard on Israel, make sure that they can never leave. And you can see it there in verse 10. If you've got your Bibles, grab them out and have a look at Exodus chapter 1, verse 10 with me. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labour. But it doesn't work, because God has not forgotten Israel. He's determined to keep his promise, and so Israel just keep on growing. And then things get really, really frightening. Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, instructs the Hebrew midwives to kill any boys born at the moment of their birth. Now just stop and think about that a moment. He's saying to them, as soon as this child comes out of the womb, break its neck, cut its throat, throw it on the rubbish dump, because we are going to control these people one way or another, and this is the way I've chosen. That is terrifying, isn't it? That is sick. And if you think about it, it gets even worse, because he wants to kill the boys but let the girls live. Why is that? Well, partly because he doesn't see women as a threat, but also, I presume, because he intends to keep them for the Egyptians. The girls are going to grow up as the sex slaves of the Egyptians, while all the boys are killed. Does that make you feel sick? I hope it does. And it's important to dwell on it for a moment, because we need to grasp the nature of the regime that we're dealing with here. This is not a country that has a bit of a different way of approaching things. This is not a government that, you know, you might have some kind of philosophical differences with about how they run the economy. No, this is Hitler level, Stalin level, North Korea level, Islamic State level evil. This is appalling evil. This is genocide. And can you imagine being one of the midwives who is told to do this? What a terrifying situation. You are dragged before the most powerful man in the world, and he commands you to do this. Kill all the boys the moment that they're born. What would you do? Because I think you could be forgiven for caving in, couldn't you? Now, it is so terrifying. And you might think, oh, well, look, he's going to do it one way or another. I might as well save my own neck. But the interesting thing is that the midwives don't. They don't do that. They actually stand up to Pharaoh. They let the Israelite boys live and they lie to Pharaoh's face about it. Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're vigorous and they give birth before the midwives can come. And in the midst of this horror and the appalling awfulness of it, there's a little flicker, a little glint of humour, isn't there? This great man, this powerful man, the most powerful man in the world, is outwitted by a couple of working class women. Pharaoh thinks that he is magnificent, but we see that actually he's pathetic. It's not that he's not frightening. He is terrifying, and the midwives are afraid. But here's the thing. They're more afraid of God than they are of Pharaoh. And their fear of God leads them to do the right thing. They stand up in the face of human evil. They refuse to cave in because they would rather be on God's side versus Pharaoh than on Pharaoh's side versus God. Their fear of God leads them to do what is right. Well, that's why dictators throughout history have oppressed Christians. Because Christians frighten them. Because Christians would rather disobey rulers who do evil than to disobey their God. And that is a terrifying thing for dictators, that the fear of God enables us to overcome the fear of men. And God does not forget. He doesn't forget the midwives. You can see that here in verse 21. Because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. And more than that, God doesn't forget them. He writes their names down in his book. Now, the extraordinary thing is that we're reading about Pharaoh, the greatest man who lived at that time. And you know what? We've got no idea who he is. He could be one of any half a dozen pharaohs who are lost in the sands of Egypt. People have tried to work out who it could be, but no one's sure. But you know what? Everyone knows who the midwives are. It's written right there. They're Shifra and Pua. Not great names, admittedly, but we know them. They're famous, and for the last 3,000 years, people have been telling their children about Shifra and Pua, these two midwives who stood up to the greatest man in the world, who feared God above men. Pharaoh, his works are lost in the sands of Egypt. But Shifra and Pua, well, their works will stand in eternity. No, it's more than that. They themselves will stand in eternity. Pharaoh, he's just some rotten corpse, some desiccated mummy. But Shifra and Pua can look forward to the resurrection of the dead, to life eternal with God, because they feared God, not man, and God did not forget. But this semester at public meeting, every Tuesday at 1 o'clock, we're going to be over in the Social Sciences Lecture Theatre. Not here, we're just here for this week, but from next week on, we'll be in Social Sciences Lecture Theatre, 1 o'clock, and we'll be hearing about what God did in Exodus. And I guess it's reasonable to ask, well, why would you do that? Why bother looking at this book that was written thousands of years ago to a people on the other side of the world with an entirely different language and culture? Why would you bother to look at that? Well, we'd bother to look at it because it's not just ancient history. It's not just a story about foreigners. I mean, it is that, and we need to respect it as that, but it's more than that. It is not just ancient foreign history. It's our history. It's our history as humans, and it's our history as Christians in particular, if you're a Christian. The history of Israel is the history of the world. See, we humans were made to be God's people, to live under his rule in his place, but we have chosen to leave. We've chosen to turn our backs on the kingdom of God. and to opt for another kingdom, a kingdom that promised life, but actually turned out to be a kingdom of slavery, of death, ruled over by sin and Satan. We're made to be ruled by a kind and loving father, and we opted to be ruled by a brutal, cruel tyrant. Made to live free under God, we turned our backs and became slaves under Satan. Held captive by him, controlled by sin and death, who crack the whip, who drive us, who control us, and who in the end will take everything that we ever produce, everything that we ever achieve. The Israel story is our story. Like Israelites born in Egypt, we're born into slavery. To quote Jesus, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. We can't set ourselves free. If you don't believe me, just try it. Try and set yourself free. Pick a sin. Pick lying. Pick gossiping. Pick putting yourself at the centre of the world. And for the next month, don't do it. See how you go. I think you might discover that you're not as free as you thought. No matter how hard we try, we just keep slipping into it. We keep rebelling against God and we keep doing what Satan wants instead. And our only hope is that in the midst of our slavery, God has not forgotten us. And the good news is, he hasn't. Like with Israel in Egypt, God sees us in our slavery, and he remembered his promise to Abraham to bless all nations through him. And he blessed us through one particular descendant of Abraham, through Jesus Christ. God has shown us that he hasn't forgotten us, that on the contrary, he loves us deeply. Now, how do we know that? Well, because while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. That is, while we were still slaves, while we were still working for the tyrant, for Satan, Christ died for us. He died for you. Christ paid the price for our sin. He bought us out of slavery by his own blood. Has God forgotten us? No, God has not forgotten us. And this semester at public meeting, we're going to keep exploring that, keep plumbing the depths of what God did for Israel in Exodus and how that connects with what he has done for us in Jesus. And as we see those come together, I think we'll get a deeper insight into both. And more than that, we're actually going to get to know God better. That's the whole point of Exodus, is to get to know God. And we get to do it together this semester. Through the Uncover program as well, inviting people to read Luke's gospel with us, we get to hold out God's offer of new life, to hold out the hope of a life free from sin and death and Satan, free from slavery. You know, the most people at UWA have got no idea that God cares for them, that he has remembered them in their slavery. In fact, most of them have no idea that they're even slaves. They're just kind of like Israel first rocking up in Egypt, thinking, hey, this is pretty good here. They don't know they're slaves, but they are. Like I said, just invite them to stop lying or gossiping or putting themselves at the centre of the world. Ask them to do it for a month. And they might discover that they're not quite as free as they thought. So this year, CU is planning a jailbreak. We are planning to spring the captives from prison, to break the chains of the oppressed, to free slaves from the most evil dictator in history. Because amidst all the horror and the pain and the sadness and suffering of this world, God has not forgotten us.